Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to the Treasures from Malta podcast, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an artist and art historian who goes back a long way with Patrimonio. In this podcast, I meet even more of Malta's living treasures. I meet artists, collectors and historians with some Malta connection, and we have conversations about their life in art. My guest today made the crossover from industry to the academic field while maintaining an art practice that has established him as one of the leading lights in the contemporary visual arts in Malta. He has attended numerous prestigious international art residencies. He has been invited to participate in countless exhibitions with important international artists and continues to explore the visual arts in both new media and traditional media such as sculpture and painting. In 2002, he set up the first contemporary art collective, named, appropriately, START, which presented some truly groundbreaking exhibitions here in Malta. In his own right, he has curated numerous exhibitions of several significant contemporary artists, both established and upcoming. He entered academia after a successful career in advertising and the graphic arts, and led the Department of Digital Arts at the University of Malta for a number of years, where he continues to nurture future talents to this very day. His credentials as an artist were sealed by not once, but twice being selected to participate in the Venice Art Biennale over the course of two decades, confirming his enduring importance as, above all, a cutting-edge contemporary artist. Vince Briffa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Francesca. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Vince, were you creative as a child, and how did you train to become an artist?
Drawing has been with me since I was a child. I remember asking my father to buy me paints, to give me paints to paint the wall of our internal yard at home.
Tolerant parents to allow you to do that.
Drawing has been my mainstay, I would say, you know, in whatever I do. My initiation to art really started with the Salesian Oratory in Sliema, mm-hmm. where I was 14 years old, mm-hmm. and I used to paint at that time. And one of the priests there had asked me to put up a small exhibition at the biblioteca. Mm-hmm. 14 years old, can you imagine? I mean, I said, I only have some paintings, but they're not framed. He said, I'll frame them for you. And he framed them, he got some easels, and I spent a whole weekend at the biblioteca sitting down on the, you know, on the front step, just awed by the fact that I'm showing my work somewhere, you know, a very, very important place.
That's remarkable. So you didn't even have formal training at that stage?
At that stage, no. Mm-hmm. It was at the time when I actually started going to Ray Pitre's atelier. So Ray Pitre has been a friend and a mentor to me for years. And so from then on, you know, sort of, I got a kind of bottega, mm-hmm. first education, mm-hmm. which later on led to other things. But however, during the same period as well, my father, who was in the RAF, actually bought me a correspondence course in what was at that time called commercial art from the British services. And I remember myself, you know, receiving the books, doing the exercises, putting everything in a package, and sending this huge package of drawings and homework to the UK to be assessed every month. So I did this every month, you know. And it was a very, very interesting experience because I used to get feedback, very interesting feedback about what I'm doing right, what I'm doing wrong, and so on and so forth. At the time, I was around 14, 15 years old when I did this, which actually got me into my first job in graphic design. I got into graphic design very early on in life, and my academic studies came later. it's also important to mention at this point in time, I think, the amount of reading. I used to read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
My father used to have a small library at home. I remember him buying me the first Dover books, for example, you know, art books
mm-hmm.
of the Impressionists, Monet, and Picasso, and so on and so forth.
This kind of widened your perspective on international art, even though there was nothing much to be seen here locally.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, so I guess I could say that I discovered the Impressionists, for example, in a day, because he got me all these books, and I got, you know what I mean? So, yeah, but I also used to read other books.
Mm-hmm.
And reading for me has been a very, very important parallel to drawing. I always look at them.
In fact, one of your media, if you like, is writing as well. It's very clear to me, even when I looked through your website when we spoke as well, that you think very deeply about your art, and you write about it, you reflect, and you discover things in your own art that then you translate into words, literally,
which
somehow communicate to the viewer. But it feels to me as well that you're trying to discover what you're saying in your art by means of words. Is that correct?
It is correct, Francesca. I mean, for me, art making is a cyclic process. It is a process of discovery, it's a process of experimentation, but it's also a process of reflection.
Mm.
And reflection cannot happen unless you have the right baggage to reflect with, I find. So, and that comes from reading. That comes from observing, reading, you know, sort of, and reading also in areas that, although are, I find parallel, but are have nothing to do with art making.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that I think is the richness of being sort of a creative person, because a creative person needs a context to create in. And the context is created through this.
In fact, you refer to philosophy, you refer to mythology, and you draw from these great traditions as well in your art. It comes across again in your writing, so
yes.
A sort of parallel art
medium,
if you like.
Mm.
So, Vince, you trained in graphic design in the 70s at a time when the birth of the home computer was just about to happen. I remember the early 80s, the Ataris and the Sinclairs, and we were all very excited about these great big boxes which made a lot of noise, but you couldn't get much out of them.
Exactly.
I remember writing basic code, but alaharis, you forget a full stop or you leave out a space because you cannot get the computer program to do what you wanted to do, which was something extremely basic. So that's the backdrop of how we remember computers at the time. And yet you sort of forged a career in a parallel space, if you like, because you were using computers, you worked on graphic art, and that became a career for you.
Yeah.
You worked in illustration and early computer technology, ultimately. Tell us about this part of your career.
Yes, as you rightly mentioned, my initial training in graphic design was pre-computer days. So it was in the era of cow gum and paste up and type markup, what you used to call type markup. So I learned, you know, sort of the hard way, as many graphic designers of my age have done so. And I don't regret a single minute of that, because that has given me a grounding, which, for example, I could say, if someone gave me a paragraph of text, I would instantly know that that paragraph would fit into a space, which will be, I don't know, 4 centimeters by 3. It will fit in a 12-point character with one letting of space in between, and so on and so forth. And this kind of training became, you know, you become very sharp when you're...
There was no space for error, really.
No.
No undo button. The magic undo button wasn't available.
Exactly.
So you had to get your act together and get
it
done right.
I remember a time when we used to do color separations by hand, you know, the four color process. We used to do it by hand on overlays, on, you know, sort of on transparent overlays. All the photography was done in-house on repro cameras, and so on and so forth. And that gave me a lot of experience. However, I was always interested in technology. My first computer was an Amiga 500. And I was really happy with it, because it could do, one of its paint programs could do an illustration with 32 colors. I mean, can you imagine? However, this Amiga 500, I remember, could be interfaced with a video recorder. So I could technically start doing some animations, you know, through the computer. And that's that was the time when, in the company that I was working in, we started thinking really about investing in computerization for, not only for desktop publishing, because that was kind of already there, more or less, but computerization for the moving image, for TV.
And it was mostly the advertising industry you were working in within your company,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
That was the
I was an art director in one of the leading advertising agencies in Malta. And I was in charge of the graphic design studio, but then again, because of my interests in technology and the way that technology was developing, we also opened an audiovisual arm, which was very, very successful at the time. And I also was sort of in charge of managing that as well.
So you were producing that. Adverts for TV?
Producing adverts, animations, documentaries, full feature films, you know, short films and stuff like that.
Despite all this, Vince, I've noticed that when you describe yourself, even in terms of what you were in the past and what you used to do, you always first describe yourself as an artist before you go on to say that now, of course, you're an academic or a curator, which is another area of your practice which is very, very strong. Now, is this deliberate, and how do you balance these various callings?
Well, yes, I think of myself as an artist first and anything else after. And it's because the way that my brain processes things. I'm an artist first because if I'm looking through a camera, I compose with an artist's eye. If I'm writing, whatever I write is visual first and then written after. So that's why I describe myself as an artist first, as a visual artist more than anything else. Now again, as you probably know, I have a problem with the word artist itself because well, I'd rather prefer creative because of the fact that sort of, you know, an artist seems a bit too...
Can I interject by quoting you back at you?
Yes.
You do say this about yourself. I am not a painter or a sculptor. I am also not a filmmaker or a writer. I produce work.
That's exactly it, because I do all these activities and at the same time, these activities are a part of me, a different parts of me. But really and truly, you know, my process is very, very simple. So it's concept which needs a medium in order to be executed. If the concept is needs photography, then I use a camera.
Yeah.
If the concept needs painting, then I paint. You know. And I find that that is, you know, at the basis of what I do.
Vince, in 1999, you were one of three artists chosen to represent Malta on the Venice Art Biennale, which, as we all know, is the most prestigious art event in the world. Firstly, can you tell us what work you presented then, sort of describe it to us? And were you also working to a team, a common team, with the other artists who were Norbert Attard and Ray Petre?
Yes, Francesca. At that time, I was going through a difficult patch in life because my sister had just died. My sister died, I think, about a couple of months before the Biennale itself. And my youngest sister. And I was going through a phase where I was doing work which was reflecting on life and death, obviously. I couldn't escape it at that time. So I presented a work which, in a sense, was quite in line with what the other two artists, Norbert Attard and Ray Petre, were actually presenting for the Biennale. The work I presented was called Hermes, which is the god who took people to the underworld, basically, and back. And so the work was a video piece, of people actually lying face up on the soil, and the soil slowly covers them. And then it uncovers you know, the soil moves again to uncover a new person and so on and so forth, sort of signifying the cycle of life in a sense. And that was a large projection, but I also had soil actually hung in the space. And so therefore one encountered not only the real soil, mm-hmm. so the smell of the soil, mm-hmm. but also the soil as a painting in a sense, and the video as a moving painting, mm-hmm. In a sense, because I wanted to place the viewer in a certain ambiguous situation whereby he's looking at people. The people are live video but do not move. And so the covering of the soil takes a very, very long time. So you don't actually perceive,
yes.
The people being covered unless you see them at the very, very end, mm-hmm. you know. And that work was dedicated to my sister, mm-hmm. and it was actually, it came about because of the time I spent with my sister in hospital. Ray Petre, I remember Ray Petre had presented two large warriors sculptures, and Norbert Attard had presented a video installation as well. We designed the whole pavilion ourselves, and it was a very kind of, the works actually made sense together, because I also produced a sound piece for the whole pavilion, which...
So did you work together to a certain extent?
Yes, yes.
You chose together?
To quite a large extent, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Because,
I had attended in 1999, and I remember your piece, and at the time, perhaps I didn't have the experience of loss that I have nowadays, and I re-experienced it through your website now. Mm-hmm. And it felt to me like if you've undergone loss and grief, then it's going to take you to a totally different space. It hit me in a very different way than it had when I had experienced it as a much younger person, obviously in 1999.
Absolutely.
It really felt like it can speak best to somebody who's understood loss.
Yes. And also it was, I guess it was also a method, a way of healing for me.
Yes,
you know,
of,
as an
of
artist.
Rationalizing death, I think.
Exactly, of getting it out of my system in a sense and coming to terms with it, you know.
Linking to this, one of the things I wanted to ask you, which kind of struck me from your writing, you write very deeply about your work, but sometimes it can be a bit impenetrable in the sense that it seems to be very reflective, and any which way I will read it, I will perhaps not quite understand what it is that you're getting at. When you're presenting an artwork and writing about it, is it important just to put it out there? Is that the catharsis that you're seeking? Or is it also important that you're communicating with your viewer?
I think my first and most important thing is that I do it for myself. Mm-hmm. And that I understand it myself. And writing is a means to understanding my own work. Because my writing does not happen before the work. It happens during and after.
Okay.
And this is interesting. This is a process that I have actually been doing for a very long time. Because writing actually helps me contextualize my work with myself and with the world out there. Now, you say that sometimes it's dense and sometimes it's impenetrable. Yes, I do understand that. However, as I said, I don't write for other people to understand. Mm-hmm. I write it for myself, in order for me to understand the work. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I write whatever I write makes sense to the various nodes or points mm-hmm. out there that it's touching with. So many times, for example, it can be a reflection on something that I've read, or something else that I've seen, or something that other people have said, you know. So it just creates that bridge for me between myself, the work, and something else out there, mm-hmm. and that's what the writing is all about. It's like threading something, you know. Mm-hmm. And reflection is like that. It's a triangulation kind of thing that helps me understand my work better. Mm-hmm. Because, as you know, Francesco, when you're working, especially in painting, for example, you do not understand what's happening at the moment. It's the whole process that really makes sense at some point, and it can be lost in a second, or it can be sort of, and if you're clever about it and you stop at the right point in time, then it can be frozen. As you said, there's no...
that difficult moment, exactly. When do you stop?
So it's a matter of starting with a vague idea, and mm-hmm. then you're applying the different media that you're using, mm-hmm. and the medium itself has its own life.
Yeah.
You know, and so therefore, you're open to errors, you're open to mishaps, you're open to surprises. But you're always reflecting back and trying to go back to the original idea.
Would you say that your present painting is related to your digital art in the sense that is it an evolution or is there a connection to your past work?
There always is, yes. I find if I look back at my work, I can find a thread that goes through the whole work from the work that I was doing in the 70s and 80s till now. And it is, I think, one of the threads is light. I'm very interested and concerned with light and with how light hits objects and how we perceive light and how we perceive color through light and so on and so forth. And it's a very impressionistic, I would say.
That's true. Back to your roots.
Back to all
reading,
yeah, exactly.
Of back impressions. To the roots.
But then you start discovering other things because digital technology has actually helped me to discover other things and helped me to understand, for example, light from a totally different perspective. So yes, I do. I never actually throw away anything, if you know what I mean. And I always ask the what if question. What if I, include this kind of technology within what I'm doing? How will it change what I'm doing? How will it inform it? How will it destroy it, perhaps,
Do you feel an obligation to evolve in the sense that not to repeat yourself? Is it a necessary precondition for artists nowadays that they have to keep evolving, they have to keep changing their art, they have to keep researching and presenting new artworks to the public?
It all depends, Francesca, at the way you position yourself, I suppose. I'm very interested and I do hope that I keep on evolving as an artist continually. However, that doesn't mean that I'm changing what my interests are. I think my interests aren't many, if you know what I mean. So I'm always working on the same four, five, six different concepts or themes. But what I do want to do is I want to change the way that I look at them. I want to change the way that I experience them. If you look at work from a totally a market perspective, I think changing very rapidly is wrong because obviously, people start expecting something out of you that you when you change, people ask, why are you changing, That does not have a value for me. I mean, my work has evolved from being very figurative to video art, to abstract, and so on and so forth. So I'm not afraid of that. I'm not afraid of it, and I actually relish it because I feel that that is what keeps me interested in what I do.
When you participated in the 1999 Biennale, did you feel that your art changed in any way by that experience? Did it affect you in any manner?
I was already changing my work in the early 1990s. My video, actually, which was part of my daily activity at the agency, early in the 1990s, I sort of stopped resisting using the tools that I use for advertising in my own artwork, in my own fine art. And I said, look, I have access to all this gear. Why not try to understand what can do from a fine art perspective? And I was already playing about with video in the mid-1990s. So my art was changing rapidly then. And it was during that time that I was approached by the committee that that was selecting artists for the Biennale to come and have a look at my work, and what I was working on, definitely. And after that, my work changed very, it evolved rather than changed. It evolved into a very strong video art driven work. However, I never neglected painting, but I didn't show that, mm-hmm. you know, I was painting. Painting and drawing for me never stopped. It was, you know, it was something that I had to go back to because it's like breathing basically for me. You know?
Another guest on this program described it exactly in those terms. This was Professor Richard England. He said drawing for him was like breathing. He had to do it every day.
Yes. In fact, the image for me, when I want to explain something, I'd rather draw it than try to explain it in words.
It's your primary language.
Exactly. It's my primary language. And most people, I think, would understand me even more if I draw something.
Let's take a break and then we'll come back to find out more. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, artist and academic Vince Briffa. And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode, including Vince's website, where you can see some of the artworks that we're discussing in this podcast. Vince, you've been on numerous art residencies. In 2018, for example, you were selected to participate in a very prestigious international art residency, which is by invitation only. And you became a fellow of that same foundation which invited you, the Civitella Ranieri Foundation. Now, what is the point of an art residency? And does it truly affect the course of your art?
I think it's yes for the second one.
It does affect your
art. It does affect your art. And I'll tell you how. The fact that you are actually away from your normal routine in a new place with new people and you have the luxury of actually thinking and working 24/7. I was there at Civitella, for example, for 6 weeks. So you can imagine, at Civitella Ranieri, I had my own studio, which was a wonderful studio, which I had access to 24/7. So I used to wake up very early. You know, being in Italy, get my espresso and go to the studio and work solidly between 8 and 1.
Don't you freeze up with the expectation, the heavy expectation that you produce remarkable work in that period because you're there and you're being hosted to produce work?
Well, yes and no, in a sense. Let me give you a bit of background about Civitella. Civitella is the... It's a 15th century castle run by a foundation from New York, right? Now, the castle hosts 6 groups of 20 artists per year between April and September. And these artists come from visual arts, from music, from writing. It's very strong in writing, actually. And so you are there for 6 weeks with these 20 or 19 high-caliber individuals. I mean, you know, really top people from different parts of the world, you know. And you become a really tightly knit group. So you're meeting these people for lunch and for dinner every day. But in between that, you're working. And you're not expected to produce anything. The nice thing about it is that if you just want to reflect on what you're doing, you can do so. There are no expectations whatsoever. However, I chose to work there. I wanted to go back to painting, you know, really, really strongly. And I produced a whole body of drawings, actually. I used to produce many drawings there. So really and truly, I wanted these 6 weeks to be a concentrated effort on actually where I should go to with my painting. And it was unbelievable because I never had the luxury of 6 weeks just thinking about my work. and nothing else.
And were you affected by all the people you were meeting and the conversations
Absolutely.
You had? Did that work into your art as well?
Absolutely. It gives you a different perspective. Even the fact that you're not doing much, but just talking with these people, mm-hmm. you know. And you become close to these people. You create links. I've shown together, you know, with other people from the group.
So the connections continue.
The connections continue. Yeah. And in art, as you well know, you know, your connections are very, very important.
So, Vince, when we met at your studio in Gouda a few weeks ago in the lead-up to this podcast, we discussed a lot of things, and amongst the things we discussed is that we should not view Maltese art in a silo. We agreed about this. We shouldn't look inwards constantly. We shouldn't try to capture the Malteseness. But instead, we ought to look out and work as part of a whole. Can you elaborate on this?
Yes, I remember a time in my early career when there were things, when what was happening abroad was difficult to come by.
Mm-hmm.
So you only discovered things through the odd book or the odd magazine, mm-hmm. you know, or some documentary on TV that you happened to stumble upon on radio or something like this. And you were all, and one was always trying to search for what's, you know, to know what's happening across the globe, because being relevant to what's happening is important for an artist, I suppose.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
All that, I must say, changed with many things that happened at the same time. One of them was our entry into the European Union, which I find was very, very important for us to change our mentality as creatives. The other one was cheap flights.
True. We could encounter the artworks in the flesh, so
exactly.
to speak.
Not only that, but also at the time when the internet became so, you know, so rich.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things actually have changed our very regional mentality into something which is very more global. No artist can actually work in a silo, because at the end of the day, whatever you're doing has to have a context. If you want to really sort of make waves, then your context needs to be strong. As artists coming from a small island, we have nothing different than artists from bigger places. From a creative point of view, there's no excuse for creating good work. Good work can be created in a kitchen room.
Absolutely. Some amazing work came out of the Holocaust in the most terrible situation that the artists found themselves in. And yet the work that was produced was so incredibly powerful and universal and came across, cuts across time. And so we really have no excuse.
Exactly. When you mentioned the Holocaust, that is why many German artists are so strong, because they have a story to tell as well.
Yeah.
And sometimes this is something that I ponder upon. I mean, what kind of story do we have to tell from a contemporary art perspective? We have to find them. There are stories, but we have to look to dig deeper. So when I say stories, narrative, the narrative that drives your work. Narrative can be very personal, but it can also be global, it can be social, it can be whatever you want it to be. So you know, in answer to your question, I think that there are no excuses nowadays of not being strong enough to participate anyway.
Mm-hmm. Vince, you left behind a successful career in commercial advertising to transition to academia quite late in life.
Yes.
In fact, you read for a PhD in 2009 at the University of Preston in the UK.
Yes.
And just a few years later, you were already heading the Department of Digital Arts at the University of Malta. Now, it might be obvious, but perhaps not. What are the digital arts exactly? And is the definition constantly evolving as new tech emerges?
Digital arts, to put it in a nutshell, is any creative activity that is mediated through a computer, right? So in the whole mix, there's also a computer involved or some kind of tech involved, right? At the digital arts department was built on the premise that digital arts is not the be-all and end-all of arts, but it's just another tool.
Mm-hmm.
So at the department, we actually pride ourselves in honing our students in the traditional arts first, and then migrating to the digital arts after. So in other words, students must know how to draw, must understand art history, must know what they're coming from. And then they will start using the digital medium in parallel with more traditional media. And that for me is the way to create strong work. Now, if a student then wants to leap totally into the digital world, that's fine.
Are you looking at AI and the Internet of Things? Are you integrating
Absolutely.
Those into your course?
Absolutely. Just before COVID, we invested in the department, I mean, and the faculty, invested in a VR cave, mm-hmm. In virtual mm-hmm. reality cave, where that's good. Obviously, that's we invested quite heavily. In collaboration with other departments at university, in order to have the latest technology available for our students. So we do AR, VR, and mixed reality, which I feel mixed reality is the next step forward.
What is mixed reality?
Mixed reality is, well, AR, for example, is part of mixed reality.
Which is augmented reality.
Exactly. Which does not cut you off from your own environment. Mm-hmm. Virtual reality does. Virtual reality cuts you off from your own environment.
You're wearing a visor, whatever,
exactly.
and you're saying...
Yes, so you're entering another reality and you're leaving behind your own reality, in a sense. I mean, I'm trying to be simplistic here. Mm-hmm. But with mixed reality, you are actually engaging with virtual data and virtual objects in your own reality.
Isn't that AR though? Isn't that
augmented reality? That's uh-huh. augmented reality. Yeah. However, augmented reality has up to now been only sparsely used.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking into developing that further.
Okay. At the department. For people to try out AR, we actually... Palazzo Falson, which is managed by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti, was one of the first museums worldwide to have an AR game, an augmented reality game, created specifically for the museum that can be played within the museum by means of people's personal devices,
yes.
so mobiles or tablets.
Yes.
So if anybody out there wants to try augmented reality on site, you can actually come over to Palazzo Falson and try the game there.
Exactly. Actually, it's very well done, Francesca. I've tried it myself. So it's a great tool. But I start asking myself then, because I get excited about these things. You know, I mean, how would an exhibition, how would a mixed reality exhibition now mm-hmm. happen? You know, how can our galleries change? You know, how can artistic production change?
Yeah.
You know,
it's just another
technology.
Tool which allows us
That's
new
exactly it.
New possibilities.
That's exactly it. And this is the way that we push mm-hmm. the digital arts at university within our department.
Vince, you're presently associate professor in the Faculty of Media and Knowledge Sciences. Now, you list screen culture and new imaging technologies
yeah.
as research interests. What exactly are they, and is the research also conducted by means of your artworks?
Yes. My research is practice-based, right? So mm-hmm. what we mean by practice-based research is that the actual artwork or object that we are creating is an object of research in itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's creating new knowledge, right? Now, screen technologies, as you know, we live on screens nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And my doctoral research was down this route because it was trying to reimagine the screen as not only something that we passively mm-hmm. look at, like cinema, okay, but also something that we engage with. Don't forget, that was a time when interactive technologies weren't mm-hmm. very, very, sort of well-developed as they are today. And with AI and all these technologies that we have
today. So, for example,
the
touch screens are
Exactly.
Specifically the sort of technology we're looking at the time.
Yes. Well, it's the use of the touchscreen. Mm-hmm. It's the use of interactivity within narrative, for example, that I'm interested in. And therefore the screen is the medium that we engage with and that we experience, mm-hmm. that through which we experience these, be they games, be they reality, different realities, be they fine art objects and so on and so forth.
So you're also looking at behavior of people interacting with screens and how they interact with screens?
Well, if you look at it from a purely cognitive process, yes, that's mm-hmm. that's the way it is. However, I'm not very interested in that. What I'm interested in the way that the screen is developing it, mm-hmm. For example, for fine art practice. That's mm-hmm. that's what I mean by screen technologies.
The potential of the screen.
Exactly.
And of technology.
It is like including the screen mm-hmm. as your alternative canvas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do I get my head around a screen as the be all and end all of, mm-hmm. of an artwork?
So would the NFTs, non-fungible tokens, be part of this? Because the NFTs live on a screen, really.
Yes, they could be. However, I'm not very interested in them myself,
What about new imaging technologies? What does that mean?
With new imaging technologies, I'm very much interested in how we create images nowadays. AI is one of the things that is creating images at this point in time, through text, for example. Mm-hmm. So there are programs that if you feed text into these programs, the AI, the intelligence behind the technology is creating or is reacting to that text and creating its own images. Mm-hmm. And these are technologies that are creating new images nowadays. So I'm interested in not only perhaps using them, because I'm interested in a way, either curating or looking at alternative means of using these technologies mm-hmm. in order to create images.
Mm-hmm. Again, a new tool. Let's see how far we can drive it and use it and exploit it.
Exactly.
Vince, this brings me around to an aspect of your career which is still very strong, which is curating. So not only are you an artist in your own right, first and foremost an artist creating, but you're also curating other artists' works. And I'm thinking of, for example, 2021, you curated the exhibition Spaces in Suspension, which was an exhibition by two experienced photographers, former students of yours as well, Joe Smith and Therese de Bono, and they tackled the theme of decay and memory of place, specifically regarding Verdala Hotel, which was about to be demolished. Mm-hmm. And very recently, just a few weeks ago, you curated an exhibition called In Between, and this was really two emerging young contemporary artists, Matthew Schembri and Thomas Sherry, working in sculpture and installation art. So even in your practice as a curator, you're tackling different media. Now, what I want to know is, how do you define a curator's role?
Although I curate exhibitions, I don't think of myself as a curator, really and truly, because I have been curating my own exhibitions for ages. Right, and you start off with curating your own exhibitions. Mm-hmm. You're putting a context to the space mm-hmm. that you're working with, because space becomes part of the whole equation. And through the installations and video art that I have produced, space was always one of the ingredients mm-hmm. of the whole mix. However, curation is not only about that. As you well know, because you have curated exhibitions, very, very interesting and very important exhibitions. Curation is also about, creating a whole look and feel and giving a statement at the end of the day about what you're showing. And part of the thing that I do enjoy when I curate exhibitions is this dialogue that goes that happens between the curator and the artist. I remember in 2012 I curated an exhibition by Cesar Attar, that's Spazio Creative, called, the exhibition was called Hardcore. And obviously, with, you know, a seasoned artist and, you know, one of the best contemporary artists that we have on the island, Cesar Attar, it's not about controlling Cesar Attar or anything. It's just working with him, you know, and getting to know the work and sort of developing the work within the space together. So, so this kind of dialogue becomes very, very important. And I find that I learn from the artists that I work with as a curator, but I also, try not to impose my own, you know, my mm-hmm. own, sort of vision too much on the work, because, curation for me is a negotiation process. Mm-hmm. And that kind of negotiation process needs to happen and needs to be quite democratic in my case, because many times it's not, you know, many times it's a top down approach, mm-hmm. you know, from the artists, from the curator to the artists. But, you know, in my case, I try to avoid that. And I do accept to curate exhibitions where this kind of dialogue happens. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't happen, I'm not interested in that. You know? As you know, with every curatorial piece comes an essay or mm-hmm. a writing. And that, for me, again, is the glue that holds everything together. So as I said, you know, with my writing, I reflect on my own work. But with my curatorial practice, I'm also reflecting and researching other people's work. And, you know, and it becomes a part of this whole process, you know. So my curatorial practice is not really separate from my mm-hmm. artistic practice. It's just an extension, I find.
In fact, how involved do you get in shaping the work while the artists are working on it? Do they consult with you? Do you give opinions that can shape the work slightly? And also, do you then design the look of the exhibition and the hang by yourself or in consultation with the artists? I mean, there's quite a bit of creative work that a curator can do, if you allow yourself to do it.
That's it. Well, with every exhibition, it's different, mm-hmm. I suppose. I mean, with every artist, it's different. So as I said, I mean, this negotiation process is key, mm-hmm. because one needs to understand the artist. You know, I mean, I'm an artist myself, so I know, and I really cringe when, you know, someone is trying to really sort of push an mm-hmm. agenda which you are not happy with, you know. So I try to avoid that mm-hmm. When I curate an exhibition. I do like looking at the work earlier on, so when the work is taking shape, and I do enjoy, you know, this discussion with the artist, especially with young artists. I do a lot of work with younger artists, and that's the part that I do enjoy. The hang itself, or the installation itself, whatever it is normally decided earlier on with the artist, mm-hmm. and in collaboration with the space.
Vince, in the intro, I mentioned that you were a founding member in 2002 of the Maltese Contemporary Artists Group, START, which held a series of groundbreaking exhibitions. And there you all mainly presented installation and video art. Now, how did that come about? And more importantly, why did it fizzle out or even disband?
That came about at a very interesting time, 2002. As I mentioned our accession to the EU, you know, and it was a time of change artistically. The start came about with really and truly with an exhibition that Mark Mangione had organized, which was called Uber. Mm-hmm. Uber was an exhibition at in St. Julian's, and Mark got us together, basically. We didn't know Mark. He had just returned from the States, I believe, at that time. And through that exhibition, we sort of we found that there's common ground, you know, to collaborate with this group of artists. And it was, and well, it was myself, but there were other artists like Rafael Bella and many other artists who took the plunge to start, which was a project that was extremely collaborative, had a very definite agenda. It was about contemporary art, you know, trying to push the contemporary art agenda in on, you know, in Malta, basically. And we held a number of interesting exhibitions. We were not tied to any museum or gallery at the time, so we used to hold exhibitions in, you know, places that were being refurbished, or for example, the Valletta waterfront that was just mm-hmm. being done at the moment. You know, so we were working with mm-hmm. with workmen, mm-hmm. basically, mm-hmm. you know, and we took pride in that because yeah. it was an interesting phase. We also used to sort of invite other artists from different genres, you know, from poetry and theater, and you know, and
music even.
And music even, exactly, to mm-hmm. to sort of collaborate with us and work with us and so on and so forth. So it was really a very, very interesting time. Mm-hmm. How did it disband? Really and truly, I mean, it's life's natural causes, I suppose. You know, people move along with their life. And there was no real problems or anything. It just fizzled out.
And yet it's was a landmark group, if you like. Yes. I think historically important because yes. they're almost the first generation of contemporary artists working in installation in Malta.
Absolutely.
At least the coming together of this group of artists was historic in that sense.
Yes.
And
yes.
there were a number of exhibitions. There was Uber, as you say, which was in the basement of Porto Marzo.
Porto Marzo, exactly.
There was Borders.
City Spaces.
City Spaces, which actually took over a very old building in Valletta.
Which had
obviously all these resonances that once it was a brothel, so it had all these sort of spirit of place which worked into your
art. Start used to work in a very site-specific, mm-hmm. Through a very site-specific idiom.
This is not to say that other artists hadn't used this form of art before, but the coming together of a number of you,
exactly.
I think, was what was particularly relevant.
Yes.
Vince, in 2019, you participated in the Vince Biennale. You were invited to represent Malta.
Yes.
What did you present there, and what was the main theme of the exhibition?
Exactly. So the 2019 exhibition, Biennale, the Maltese Pavilion was called Malev, which is the word for port, basically, you know. And so what I presented was a work called Outland. It was a multi-channel projection with water. And the work centered on, well, I look at the work as a self-portrait, actually. It centered on the reality of being caught on, you know, in a place. Mm-hmm. And always longing to leave the place. Even if the place is very comfortable to you.
Now, we've heard that story before.
Exactly. And the story goes back to mythology, yeah? With Calypso and Ulysses, right? And so I reworked Calypso and Ulysses in a local context. And so I enjoyed doing this because I worked with two professionals, Paul Portelli and Sandra Mifsud, who are excellent people to work with. And I directed this piece, which shows the two realities of these people. You know, a person who is caught in his own world, caught within his own world, and oblivious of what's happening around him. And at the same time, the person wants to leave, but doesn't know how to do that. You know, and it's the work was very well received at Biennale. It won an award, which I was very, very happy about, because it's not something that happens every day, you know, to an artist to win an award.
And the amount of work that is on display in the Venice Biennale is remarkable.
Exactly.
So to be singled out is really quite something.
That's it. And I must say that it was a very interesting experience, a very good experience working with the two other artists, mm-hmm. Trevor Borch and with Klitz Antoniou, who's an artist from Cyprus. In creating the pavilion, which was curated by another Cypriot, Hesperi Aliadou, we were a very compact team, and I must say that we, you know, we did very well because the pavilion was ranked as one of the top 10 pavilions in the Biennale. So, yeah, I'm happy about it.
Finally, Vince, the last question. Of all the museums and spaces you've visited and worked in, which is your ideal one and why?
This is a very difficult question because I have worked in so many different contexts and museums. But I mentioned two. One of them is the NRW Forum in Düsseldorf, which is a contemporary art space. It's a fantastic contemporary art space. That is the ideal neutral space where to work in. So you could actually create anything in the space because it's neutral.
White box, your white box.
It is a white box, mm-hmm. essentially, or white boxes. Mm-hmm. I worked in that space, but I also curated an exhibition of young Maltese artists there. So that is a space that I really love to work in. Another one was the Johanniter Kirche in Austria, which is a cathedral, which is also only used by it's only used for exhibitions, as there's a long story. They had found some Roman ruins in the, you know, some Roman walls underneath the ground, and they couldn't cover them up. And at the same time, they couldn't use it as a cathedral. And so
it comes laden with stories in its own
exactly.
right. And even the space is obviously quite decorative, I would imagine.
Yes. And so they involved a curator in order to use the space as an exhibition space. I was invited twice to create an installation in the space. It's a huge space, and it's a very terrifying space if you don't know how to handle it. And so this also was a challenge for me that I really loved.
Well, Vince, thank you so much for your time and for giving us an insight into your art process, your art thinking, your practice through the years, and just sharing with us your insights, which have been truly remarkable, truly deep.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.